Let's try to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago. We started a series a number of weeks ago for those of you who are maybe visiting today on this Labor Day Sunday, or for those of you watching online that have not been following every lesson. We started a number of weeks ago with my sharing a couple of presentations that I do on the Constitution and the Declaration. Now, some would say, well, I don't understand how that fits into a Bible class. Well, it fits into a Bible class because we Christians live in a representative republic. We ought to know how it works. And because we don't know how it works, we Christians are in danger of being driven underground. So that's one reason. Second reason is those documents, those founding documents that we have, were birthed in an atmosphere in a time when the church was a strong influence in the American culture. Now, I don't believe that the Constitution nor the Declaration are divinely inspired documents. And I've heard some people make that statement. I think what they believe, but it gets dangerously close to heresy because only God's Word is divinely inspired. So I believe God's Word is the standard for all truth. But I do believe that people can be inspired by the Lord to write certain things. It's just whatever a human writes is secondary to God's Word. So I need to always keep those separate. The Constitution is not an infallible document. We've seen that. We kind of got the cart before the horse, and I taught on the Constitution first, and then you guys enjoyed it enough that we went back and grabbed the Declaration. Doing it in order, we should have started with the Declaration. If you're going to call one of them an inspired document in that the writers may have been inspired by the Lord, I think the Declaration is far more that document, much closer to that idea. Remember that the Constitution is simply the way to put the Declaration into practice. That's really all the Constitution is. And unfortunately, it's been amended and things have been read into it now for so many decades that really it's not the Constitution the framers wrote. It's been greatly damaged by many of the amendments, certainly by doctrines that have been read into it by the courts. And so we're really struggling today with understanding the original intent of the Constitution. The Declaration is so different in that it can't be amended, and it's not all that difficult to understand what they were saying and what they intended. It is the birth certificate of the nation, and I think, therefore, we must understand. We need to understand the Constitution, certainly, but we must understand the Declaration of Independence. So we began a couple of weeks ago calling the Declaration our most critical founding document. Well, if it's our most critical founding document, then obviously it's filled with critical concepts, right? So that's where we are now. So we're going to pick up there. So this is the Declaration. This is the birth certificate of our republic. Unfortunately, most people never talk about the Declaration. The talking heads on television and radio seldom talk about the Declaration unless they're conservatives who really know our history. All we talk about is the Constitution. That's really a mistake. That's kind of like putting all the emphasis on the church constitution but forgetting the Bible. We don't preach from the church constitution. All church constitutions are different. If they're proper, then they're based upon biblical principle. But it's not the constitution of the church from which we preach. We preach from the founding document, which is the Word of God, right? Well, it's the same with the church constitution. So the Bible is our Declaration of Independence. It holds the concepts, the precepts. And then our church constitution, well, that's just how we govern ourselves. And that's very important that we make that distinction. It's also important to note that when Abraham Lincoln shows up on November the 17th, 1863, to a place called Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, to participate in the dedication ceremonies of that battlefield. And here's one of the only photographs of Lincoln at the address. The photographers didn't get any pictures of him because his speech was so short and they didn't have time to adjust. They thought he was going to speak for an hour or so and had plenty of time. Well, he speaks a little over 2 minutes. So especially in those days with those cameras, you can't move fast. And these guys miss Lincoln except for just a few photographs that are taken of the speaker's rostrum. And of course, there's Lincoln there. But when he does show up in Gettysburg to deliver this two and a half minute address that many believe to be one of the better speeches ever delivered by a president, he begins the history of our country not with the Constitution. And I think that is very important. He begins in 1863 with 87 years ago. Well, if you do the arithmetic, that takes you back to 1776, not to 1787 and the Constitutional Convention. So Lincoln knew that the Declaration is the birth certificate of the nation. Our beginning is the Declaration, not the Constitution. And that's very important. And I think that's a point that many miss today. Now, I'm not sure if I've given you this quote from John Adams, but if I have, please bear with me. If I haven't, it's worth listening to what he said about the reason that governments and proper governments are so important. And he says, to expect self-denial from men when they have a majority in their favor and consequently power to gratify themselves is to disbelieve all history and universal experience. It is to disbelieve revelation and the word of God, which informs us the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Now, here's his point. If there aren't rules by which we live, then people will use power in very nefarious ways. Do not expect men generally to do the right thing with power. They're just not going to. The human heart is fallen, and Jeremiah says, who can know it? He goes on to say, such exalted virtue never yet existed in any large body of men and lasted long. There is no man, he says, so blind as not to see that to talk of founding a government upon a supposition that nations and great bodies of men left to themselves will practice a course of self-denial is either to babble like a newborn infant or to deceive like an unprincipled imposter. Now, what he's trying to warn us here is that men are not good, and men tend to seek power. They tend to seek it for selfish reasons. Power tends to consolidate itself. Bill Federer makes a great point of that in his From Change to Chains, a 6,000-year quest for power. And he tells us that power always wants to consolidate itself, and it does. So very seldom is authority used with an open hand. Typically, authority is used with a closed fist. Our experiment here in North America has been very unique, very rare. We've already talked about this before. Self-governance is a very rare thing in history, and it's very fragile. And if you don't guard it, it will be lost. This is why Franklin told Mrs. Powell outside the Constitutional Convention when it adjourned that we've given your republic, Mrs. Powell, if you can keep it. If you can keep it. Because power tends to consolidate. Self-governance always devolves into some type of oligarchy, dictatorship, or tyranny. That's just the way it is. So Adams here is simply warning us that to expect men to do the right thing and to do good things with power is kind of a fool's errand, and we must be careful about that. Now, let's go back and remind ourselves from our previous outline the concepts that we've talked about at this point coming out of the Declaration. There are many. Obviously, we can't spend forever. But the critical concept number one is that even though it's not in the Declaration, it's evidenced in the grievances that they write at the end of the Declaration, those 27 grievances, they did not want to separate. Now, if you weren't here in the first lesson 2 weeks ago, you need to go back and listen to that online, because I give quote after quote after quote after quote from the pastors of that period of time who were saying that they never wanted to separate from Great Britain. They considered themselves Englishmen. What they wanted the king to do was to honor the English Constitution, the English Bill of Rights, and to simply do what he said he would do, and Parliament the same. They did not want to separate. They did not want a war. And so, like I said, I gave you many, many examples of that. Because today, the framers, and I call these men framers, founders in my mind are back around the Pilgrim era, a little over 100 years before. The framers are framed today as rebels and bloodthirsty, promoting slavery, just horrible elitists. Well, it's just simply not true. Now, could it be true of some of them? Probably. I mean, not everybody was, a squeaky clean saint. I don't know how many of them were actually born again. A lot of them claimed to be Christians. Most of them had a healthy respect for the Bible and the God of the Bible. How many of them were truly born again? I do not know. But here's the point. These men were not what they're framed up to be today. Perfect? No. Horribly demented, as we're led to believe today? No. It's just simply not true. The slavery issue we'll get into hopefully today a little bit as we move through the concepts. Concept number two is that we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, they didn't think they needed to prove all these things because they ought to just be obvious to everyone. Truths like if you jump off of your house, you're going to go downward, not upward. I mean, it's just that would be obvious, right? We don't have to stand here and prove to you. But if you need proof, jump, and you'll find the proof very quickly. So it's just self-evident. And so they said, look, these truths are pretty self-evident. Now, there's something else here that I want to inject into this discussion. And this really, this quote and quotes like them are addressing the Constitution. But if you back up a few years, they could also be applied to the Declaration. And that is this. We tend to look at things from the eyes or through the eyes of when we live. So for instance, today we discuss slavery from a 21st century perspective. Well, that many times is very unfair to those living at the time it was a real issue, 18th and 19th century. If the Lord does not return and our republic remains, I do believe there will be a time when abortion is seen as the evil that it is, and it's done away with. Whether that takes a separation of the states into two countries instead of, you know, one union, I don't know. But I do believe that there'll come a day, if the Lord doesn't return and we don't just go downward so fast that we lose all morality, abortion's going to come to an end. I just simply believe that. Now, let's say that I'm correct, and people look back at us from the 22nd century, and they judge us as not doing anything to end abortion, and how in the world could they have allowed that? Well, we're not allowing it. We're doing everything we know how to do, and then some, to try to end it. Much of it legislative and gets shot down by the courts. I ran for governor with one of the single purposes of creating kind of a constitutional crisis and to see whether or not states have any sovereignty left by ending abortion in Oklahoma. I would do many other things, obviously, but many of us are trying. But in the 22nd century, they may just lump us all together and assume that we didn't care, we weren't trying, and we supported abortion. Because they might not understand the shoes in which we walk. So we have to be very careful when looking at the 18th century, 17th century, 19th century, that we understand we don't see it the way they were seeing it when they were living. That doesn't mean they were right. It's not to make excuse. But it's just a fact. We have to get within the context of what we're talking about. Now, this is where Jefferson's comment then becomes very useful. He was writing to a Supreme Court Justice, William Johnson, and they're talking about the Constitution and how it should function with the judiciary. And I want you to listen to what he said. On every question of construction, now here he's referring to the Constitution, but it would also be true about the Declaration. Let us carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, and instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. Now, isn't that a novel thought? To actually go back and try to understand the original intent. Try to understand what they were thinking, what they were trying to say in their historical, cultural context. If we would do that, the Black Lives Matter lie about all the framers being slave lovers or slavery lovers and just, you know, inconsiderate of individual worth and value would simply fade away. Many of these men risked everything they had to declare independence from Great Britain because they knew if they didn't, slavery would never end. many blacks actually fought in the Continental Army because they knew their greatest chance for ultimate freedom is if the colonies won their freedom from Great Britain. So understand, we're not being given the whole story. And this is why understanding history, you don't have to be a historian. You can be a good student of history. That's what I am. Well, I don't know about good. A student of history, at least, is what I am. But by understanding history, we don't make these common mistakes. Now, in the same vein, here's James Madison. And the reason why I quote a lot from Jefferson and Madison is simply because they are the primary authors of our two founding documents. Jefferson is the primary author of the Declaration. Obviously, Madison is the primary author of the Constitution. Now, I want you to listen to what Madison says in 1824. Now, this is a pretty good distance down the road from the completion of our two founding documents. Listen to what he says. I entirely concur in the propriety of restoring to the sense in which the Constitution was accepted and ratified by the nation. In that sense alone, it is the legitimate Constitution. I want you to think about that last line for just a moment. For all of these folks who are constantly quoting from the Constitution, Madison is saying that it is only the legitimate Constitution if you take it back to its original context. This is why I argue when people say, well, Dan, don't you think if we just get back to the Constitution, we'll be okay? I always ask them, which one? Is it the one that was originally written with the original context and intent, or is it the one we have today that's been added to, misinterpreted, and gutted? Right? I mean, for you say, well, how? Well, just one example. The 17th Amendment changed the way senators are chosen, but do you realize that one little change basically deconstructed the Constitution? You say, well, how's that possible? Well, remember, the senators were once chosen by the state legislatures, and their job was to go to the central government, which today is located in Washington, D.C., to watch over their state's welfare. It's really not the people individually that they are there to watch over, although obviously the state is nothing without the people, so the state is the people. But the job of the senator was to watch over the sovereignty of their state. And if they didn't do that, the legislature had the authority to call them back, rebuke them, reprimand them, straighten them out, and send them back. And if they still didn't do it, the legislature had the authority to remove them and put someone else in their place. Now today, you say, well, wait, why weren't the people represented? They were. The House of Representatives. See, the House of Representatives, those members are elected by popular vote. The people directly choose those. Now, they indirectly choose the senators because they elect their legislators in their state. So, see, it's still representative. But the House of Representatives directly represented the people. Senators represented the state. Now, once the 17th Amendment changed that to the senators are now elected by the people, what you in essence have is two houses of representatives now. And since the Senate thinks they're more elite than the House of Representatives, what they really work like is the House of Lords, and the House of Representatives works like the House of Commons. What does that sound like? Well, that's Parliament. And then when you have presidents who believe they're monarchs, we basically have the kind of government we fought a war to get away from. So now senators are no longer watching over the welfare of the state. Senators are doing the bidding of their constituents. Well, I thought that's what the representatives did. So now you have two houses of representatives. So since the 17th Amendment was passed, there's been no one in Washington protecting the sovereignty of the individual states. Shouldn't be a surprise then that state sovereignty has gone out the window. The states no longer matter. They're basically the helpers to do what the federal government says to do in most people's minds. They don't understand that it was the states that created the central government and loaned the authority that the federal government or the central government has. They loaned it to them. From where? From the states. This is why they weren't going to ratify the Constitution and why the Bill of Rights had to be written to appease these fears. The Constitution only gave the positive powers of the federal government. It didn't give the negative powers, so the Bill of Rights comes along and lists what they can't do. And then at the very end, they said, in case we've forgotten anything and haven't made it clear, Amendment number 9, all power ultimately resides in the people. And Amendment number 10, the states are sovereign. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what it means. That was to clarify so that everyone would understand. Okay, so here he says it's only legitimate in its original sense. What a metamorphosis would be produced in the code of law if all its ancient phraseology were to be taken in its modern sense. So what Madison is saying is if you take the Constitution, or I would even argue the Declaration, you pluck the words out of the 18th century and you transplant them into the 21st century with definition and emphasis changes, you've changed the document. It no longer means what it meant. So just changing the way the senators are chosen basically unhinged the way our federal government is supposed to work. Now, that might not have seemed to be a big deal to people at one time, but the folks who were making it happen knew what they were doing. Most people don't even know that. They don't even understand the difference that the 17th Amendment made. This is why staying within the context is so important. Now, let's go to concept number 3. We began it last time. I wanted to add these things just so it helps to fill in the gaps in our thinking. Critical concept number 3, the laws of nature and of nature's God. In the Declaration of Independence, they tell us that everything about truth and legal jurisprudence is based upon the laws of nature and of nature's God. Now, those statements basically come from two individuals. We talked about one of them, John Locke and Sir William Blackstone. Those are the two who were probably the most well-known for promoting those concepts of laws of nature and of nature's God. Now, today, most people don't even know who William Blackstone was. All they hear about is John Locke. And the reason for that is because modern teachers and professors and all have been successful in framing Locke as a hedonist who didn't really believe in God and was just a humanist. And therefore, the laws of nature would be the law of the jungle, survival of the fittest, whoever can be the strongest wins. And they basically try to concoct a founding of America devoid of its Christian moorings. Okay, so that's why you only hear about John Locke. I'm going to show you today that that was not true even about John Locke. But Sir William Blackstone, we gave a couple of his quotes. And I'm not sure that we covered those there at the very bottom of last outline, handout number 1. He says, man considered as a creature must necessarily, he says, be subject to the laws of his creator, capital C. He's obviously talking about God. For he is entirely a dependent being, meaning man is a dependent being, dependent on God. And consequently, as man depends absolutely upon his maker, capital M, he's talking about God again, for everything, it is necessary that he should in all points conform to his maker's will. So Blackstone's making it very, very clear that man lives and functions under God's will. He goes on to say, this will of his maker is called the law of nature. Okay, hear me now. Now there's the phrase, the law of nature. The doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and he's talking about the Bible, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. No human laws should be suffered to contradict these. So what Blackstone was teaching in his day, and he was a very influential teacher and authority on jurisprudence, he's teaching that ultimately we are under God, responsible to him, dependent on him, and that we live by the laws of nature, but that God is the God of nature. So ultimately, all of our laws have to be in congruence with his laws. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's what Blackstone taught. Now let's go to John Locke. Most people don't even talk about Blackstone. So most people, when they hear about Sir William Blackstone, they say, who? They don't even know it. But they have heard of John Locke. Now, let's read some quotes from John Locke, not lifted out of context here. We're going to be fair with his statement. This is in his two treaties of civil government that he wrote in 1689. So almost 100 years before the writing of the Declaration. Not quite, but really close. Listen to what he says. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it. Now see, we're talking about nature's law, the laws of nature and nature's God, which obliges everyone. And reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. Now, the reason why that quote is important is because, first of all, he's telling us that we live under the laws of nature. And he just a moment, he's going to talk about nature's God, but there's the law of nature again. But notice here at the bottom, he says that no one ought to harm another person's life, health, liberty, or possessions. Does that sound vaguely familiar to anything? Yeah, in the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By the way, the pursuit of happiness was actually an agreed-upon phrase, because originally it was private property, is what they were going to write down there, because the ability to accumulate wealth and to own property is the pursuit of happiness, right? Well, they got that from John Locke. Life, health, liberty, or possessions. Possessions becomes pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence. But that's what they meant. When they said pursuit of happiness, they didn't mean just do whatever makes you happy. Just like general welfare doesn't mean a welfare check. When you come across the phrase general welfare in the Constitution, it's not talking about a welfare check that you and I who work subsidize those who won't. Now, some can't, and society needs to have safety nets for those. But most people who receive government aid could work. They won't work. That's not what general welfare meant. It just simply meant the welfare generally of everyone. Paul and I want general welfare for Fairview, but that doesn't mean that we believe we ought to subsidize everybody who won't work. Well, the idea of pursuit of happiness didn't mean go do what makes you happy. It meant the pursuit of life goals to accomplish certain things and have things. That possessions. It comes directly out of John Locke. All right, let's move to another important statement from John Locke. This is out of his Essays on the Law of Nature, number 4, written in 1676. Okay, now we're basically 100 years before the Declaration. Listen to what he says. Reason lays down that there must be some superior power to which we are rightly subject, namely God. How many of you have ever heard that John Locke talked about and believed in God? You'd be led to believe today that John Locke was an atheist, or at the very best, a deist. But here he's saying, look, we have a power to which we are subjected, and that is the power of God. Who has, he says, a just and inevitable command over us, and at his pleasure can raise us up or throw us down. By the way, does that sound like a deist? Remember what a deist is. A deist is a person who believes that if there's a God, he made the universe and then walked away and has no interaction with it. That's what a deist is. If you need an outline, this is handout number 1. If you need a number 1, we're already past that. So you're like always day late and dollar short. But anyway, just kidding. That's outline number 1. Now notice what he's saying here. That God can either raise us up or throw us down. So that's an interactive God that John Locke's talking about here. And make us by the same commanding power happy or miserable. Well, again, that's not a deist speaking here. That's a man speaking about one who apparently believes in God. Now, that doesn't make him a Christian, remember. But it does make him a believer in God, not an atheist. And because he believes that God is interacting, he wouldn't be a deist. I wrote one chapter in a book that Ken Ham put together. We had different authors write different chapters, and my assignment was the subject of deism. And in one chapter, you can't deal with deism, but my job was to deal with deism in one chapter, so I did. It's in a book that's sold in the Creation Museum and at the Ark Encounter, on critical principles that we live by. And in that chapter on deism, this is the very point that I made. You cannot believe that God is interactive if you're a deist. Okay, let's go to another quote from John Locke. This is in his Of Ethics in General. He says, to establish morality, therefore, upon its proper basis, and such foundations as may carry an obligation with them, we must first prove a law, which always supposes a lawmaker, one that has a superiority and right to ordain. So he's talking about you can't make a law if you're not in charge. So we talk about the laws of nature. Someone has to be in charge of nature, and guess who it isn't? Well, it isn't us. When was the last time that you commanded a tornado to go somewhere? When was the last time that you could stop a hurricane or cause one? Okay, so nature operates by laws, ultimately from a lawgiver and maker named God. And also a power to reward and punish according to the tenor of the law established by him. This sovereign lawmaker, now notice he says there is a sovereign lawmaker above the legislature who has set rules and bounds to the actions of men, is God their maker. So this is John Locke saying that God is the ultimate lawmaker and lawgiver. All right, let's go back to 1689 and his two treaties of civil government, the second volume of that. He says, thus, the law of nature stands as an eternal rule to all men, legislators as well as others. So he's saying, look, the government is subject to the laws of nature. The rules that they make for other men's actions must be conformable to the law of nature, i.e., what do I mean by that? The will of God. So right there, we now know what the laws of nature in the Declaration means according to John Locke. The will of God. So when you see in the Declaration the laws of nature and nature's God, you could replace that with the will of God. Capital G. Now do you see why I say that the Declaration of Independence had incredibly strong Christian roots, because they're drawing directly from the idea that God is the sovereign over nature and that all that we do, including the laws we make, are subject to God's laws. Even Locke accepts that. Of which that is a declaration and the fundamental law of nature being the preservation of mankind. So now you're beginning to get the idea of how these framers, when they write the Declaration, primarily Jefferson, but the Committee of Five, as they're refining the Declaration, they're pulling from Blackstone and certainly from Locke, and they understand that the laws of nature and nature's God are the God of the Bible, the Christian God, the Judeo-Christian God. Very important. This may not be revolutionary to you, but man, it is revolutionary to me. Because I've always been taught that the laws of nature and nature's God is just kind of the law of the jungle, and the framers were deists at best, and they really didn't believe in God, and there's no Christian influence in our founding documents. It's the opposite of that. All right, one other quote, I believe, from Locke, and this is from his The Reasonableness of Christianity that he wrote in 1695. He says, such a law of morality Jesus Christ has given us in the New Testament. But by the latter of these ways, we have from him a full and sufficient rule for our direction and conformable to that of reason. So in other words, he says that human reason that is proper conforms to the word of God found in the New Testament. Here, morality has a sure standard from God, the great lawmaker. Now, by the way, those quotes are taken in context. I leave out some of it because the quote would be so long that it wouldn't be usable in a class setting. But I've not done any damage to his original intent. So his point is, whether he was a Christian or not, I cannot tell you. But he tells us that perfect morality is found in the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament, and that is the basis for all reasonable law. So that's John Locke. Now carry that forward to the framers when they say the laws of nature and nature's God. What did they mean? They meant the God of the Bible, and that any laws we make should be conformable to the higher laws of God as laid down in the Old and New Testaments. I'm not making that up. It's very important. Okay, critical concept number four. I'm taking these kind of in the order of the Declaration. We're not reading the whole text. We've already done that in a previous lesson. All men are created equal. This is critical concept number four. Now, this is where today the Black Lives Matter Marxist groups are making hay because they claim that the founders were lying. They owned slaves. They were pro-slavery. They didn't believe all men were equal. They were white elitists. This is where critical race theory comes in and says all whites are elitist and supreme and therefore are all racist whether they know it or not. It's critical race theory. Well, is that actually true? Did some of them own slaves? Yes, they did. Did some of them believe slavery was acceptable? Yes, some of them did. But you must understand that they lived in a time where slavery had been in North America for almost 200 years. Some of them had inherited the slaves that they owned. Not all. I want to be fair here. Robert E. Lee, for instance, had slaves later on, 100 years later, basically 100 years later. He inherited those slaves from his wife. So it's kind of a complicated story when you begin to talk about slavery. But see, from us in the 21st century, it's not. We see slavery as wrong. And anybody who had slaves must have been a horrible person and mistreated those slaves, and it was just terrible. Because we've been given a caricature, a stereotype that is not a true reflection of history. Is slavery right? No. Am I trying to make excuses for framers who owned slaves? No. But let me let you in on a little secret. Many people who were godly people were still negatively influenced by the culture of their day and didn't always do the right thing. How many of you know who Jonathan Edwards was? Does anybody know the sermon he's most famous for? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was probably the greatest sermon delivered during the First Great Awakening. Stories about how that affected people are just beyond normal. They're supernatural. Did you know that he owned slaves? Most people do not know Jonathan Edwards owned slaves. His son, Jonathan Edwards II or Jonathan Edwards Jr., actually was an abolitionist and fought slavery. But the Jonathan Edwards that preached the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, owned slaves. Now, I'm not saying that to defame Jonathan Edwards. What I'm saying is just because people are trying to be the people God wants them to be doesn't mean that they don't have problems in their own lives and aren't influenced by the culture of their day. It's very important to look at the issue of slavery from the perspective of the 18th and the 19th century rather than just the 21st century. Now, let's deal with this then. Were the framers pro-slavery? Actually, no. Now I've made this point before, but the 28th grievance against King George that was removed from the Declaration said this. He, meaning King George, has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. Now, what Jefferson is talking about there is the slave trade and slaves on these slave ships and many of them dying because of the conditions. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. Now, to put it in common language, Jefferson is ripping King George in the Declaration because he wouldn't let the colonies outlaw slavery. Most people do not know that it was actually against the law to free slaves under English law when the 13 colonies were still under English rule. When you read the Declaration of Independence, when you get to the end of it, there are 27 grievances, not 28. And here's the reason why this grievance doesn't make it to the Declaration. Thank you, Miss Lucy. The reason why this grievance does not make it to the Declaration is because they convinced Jefferson and the Committee of Five to take it out. Because if they left it, they would lose the southern colonies. And even though they disdained the slavery in the southern colonies, primarily North Carolina and Georgia, they knew that if they didn't keep all 13 colonies together, they had no chance of winning a war, if it came to that, against Great Britain. They believed that if they could win their independence, they could deal with slavery. They could not envision what was coming next, which was the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney and the explosion of the cotton market. They didn't know that. They didn't have crystal balls. So understand that they were going to rip King George about not allowing them to outlaw slavery in North America. Most people are appalled to learn that. You can go online and download that. The 28th grievance that was removed is common knowledge if you know where to look. Okay, so one last thing, and then let's call it quits here. I know the bell rang, but let's deal with this. Today you hear people talk about the three-fifths compromise. They say, well, you see, our framers believe that blacks were just three-fifths of a person. That is not what the three-fifths compromise even was. Remember that the southern colonies wanted to exert great power into how slavery was going to spread into the other colonies, i.e. states. Well, they, meaning the anti-slavery people, were very afraid that if the southern colonies were able to count their slaves to determine representation in Congress, that the slaveholding states would have an advantage and they would push slavery on the rest of the country. So here's what they did. They agreed upon a three-fifths compromise on June the 11th, 1787. Now here's what that three-fifths compromise said. You can only count three-fifths of your slaves to be counted toward representation in Congress. They weren't saying that slaves are three-fifths of a person. This is actually a pro-liberty, anti-slavery compromise. This is one of the steps. Now, we may hate the word compromise, but this is one of the political steps that they were willing to take to try to end slavery. And they believed the way they could do it was to limit the influence that the slave states had on the Congress. So when you hear someone talk about the three-fifths compromise today and they use it as a pro-slavery, it was actually an anti-slavery measure. It's the opposite of what you're told. So when they said all men are created equal, that is a general truth that they believed, and they intended to make good on that, even with the issue of slavery, and the history proves it. Now, America has a dark spot on its history because of slavery. I'll be the first to admit to you. But we're the only country that's gone to the lengths that we have gone to try to end it. I don't have time to go any further today. I'm way out of time. So let's stop right there. I'll pick up next week with critical concept. What is it? Number five? Is it number five or number six? Number five. We'll pick up with critical concept number five next week. Thank you for your indulgence. Appreciate it. We'll have service here in a little while.